I've been traveling around doing my usual rounds of the various churches, preaching, teaching, meeting with youth and family people, and it's good to be back home again. Now, the good news is, or the bad news, whichever way you look at it, is next year I'm not going to travel. So you have me for the whole year. I'm here. I'm at home for the whole year. So that's exciting. I'm excited about that. And it'll be great to just have a full year together without me being distracted of going away. We'll be together. It'll be great. Okay, so how have you enjoyed the Hebrew series? You really enjoyed it? Me too. I really loved it. When you thought you'd finally escaped and it was all over, I'm going to go back and revisit a couple of bits. All right? So I enjoyed it so much. It happens to be one of my favorite books in the Bible. I didn't teach any of the classes here in the East. I thought I'd have the opportunity today to say something about Hebrews. So here are some final thoughts on the book of Hebrews. We're going to start with a little bit in chapter 8, and then we're going to go to chapter 13. But when I studied it, the thing that it really did for me was it got me to think more deeply about my walk with God, particularly my connection with God. And so this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to deal with a little bit of of chapter 8, particularly the bit about the covenant, and take you through the Old Covenant, New Covenant kind of ideas. And then I'm going to give you two very practical, very specific challenges from chapter 13 related to your walk with God. I hope that's okay with you. Well, let's do them together over Christmas, right? Okay, I may only have time for one. The two challenges are to do with purity and to do with prayer. But I may just have time for one. Point. Mike said he listened to a sermon I did in the Northwest on Hebrews 13, which some of this material comes from, but not all of it. And he said the recording stopped halfway through. So I don't know if I just spoke too long and the batteries ran out or something like that. But anyway, I'll try and keep an eye on the time. I know I have a bit of I sometimes can speak over. Better get on with it, really, hey? Okay, so less of the small talk. Chapter 7 then establishes that priests did not necessarily have to come from the tribe of Levi, the example being Melchizedek, and that Jesus qualified to be a high priest because of his sacrificial life, not because of his family line. And it also mentioned that the old covenant was to be replaced with a new covenant, and Hebrews 8 continues these ideas, and we pick up in verse 6 of chapter 8. Okay, so I'll read that now. But in fact, the ministry Jesus has received is as superior to theirs, that's the Old Testament priest, as the covenant of which he is mediator is superior to the old one, since the new covenant is established on better promises. For if there had been nothing wrong with that first covenant, no place would have been sought for another. But God found fault with the people and said, "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and with the people of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand to lead them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant, and I turned away from them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will establish with the people of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my laws in their minds and write them on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. No longer will they teach their neighbor or say to one another, 'Know the Lord,' because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, for I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more. By calling this covenant new, he made the first one obsolete, and what is obsolete and outdated will soon disappear." So, a covenant then is a two-sided agreement outlining a commitment and establishing the relationship and obligation to each other. Okay, I like the way the Quiet Time booklet that the teachers prepared compared it to a marriage as perhaps the best example we have of covenant in this modern world. And it's expressed in the vows that we make at marriage. We don't need reminding about the vows on the honeymoon, or at least in most cases, that's not. There are one or two, I'm sure, where we perhaps did. And I don't want you to feel bad if that was you, okay? And, you know, it's a journey, it's a lifetime thing, and we have time to figure these things out. But I'm making a generalized statement. So, on the honeymoon period, but challenges come in marriage, and it may be appropriate at times to remind ourselves of the vows that we took when we first got married. Our God is a God of covenants. He makes covenants with men. He made a covenant with Adam in the Garden of Eden. He told Adam and Eve, he said, they could eat from any tree in the garden except the tree in the middle. They were not supposed to eat from the tree in the middle of the garden, because if they eat from that tree, they're going to die. Now, that wasn't a threat. It was just a fact. And he was telling the truth. If you eat from that tree, you are going to die. Don't eat from it. I care about you. I have your best interests at heart. And trust me, I know that tree. I made that tree. And if you eat from it, you're going to die. So, and I don't want you to die. I want you to live. So don't eat from it. And of course, they decide that either they know better than God, or that they have their best interests at heart and God doesn't, and then the world changes forever in one bite of a fruit from a tree. Sin defined simply is trusting ourself over God. You know better than God. That's what sin is. Actually, I know better than God. I'm not going to trust that God knows better than me. Or you have your best interests at heart, but God doesn't. You don't trust that God does. And so, obviously, some sins in this life have a greater consequence than others, but at its heart, sin is rebellion and a lack of trust of God and trusting ourselves more than God. And therefore, it's all the same in God's eyes. God then, in this situation, he gets his hands dirty. Adam and Eve were not meat eaters. They only ate fruit. The Bible talks about that. This is the first recorded physical death in the Bible. An animal was killed, and God clothes them in animal skins, and which implies that he killed an animal. He demonstrates that sin costs blood. The only way man's sin could be covered was through the shedding of blood. The Hebrew word for atonement used throughout the Old Testament literally means covering, and that's what God did here. He covered them with animal skins. Fast forward, he made a covenant with Noah. The word covenant is used for the first time in the Bible. 1700 years of downward spiral into deeper and deeper disregard for God in human history. And we read the story of Noah, and you can think he's a bit harsh. But he waited 1700 years to bring a judgment like this in the day of Noah. How patient are you? I mean, I can struggle with 17 minutes, and I'm a patient guy, but this is 1700 years. And the Bible tells us, if you go back and study this in Genesis, that it doesn't say that he was filled with anger, but it says that his heart was grieved, his heart was filled with pain. And he even told Enoch that a judgment was coming. That was 700 years before Noah. So there was a 700-year warning. He then, I don't know if you remember, also you can read in Genesis where God says man's time will be 120 years. I don't think he's talking about lifespan. I think there's 120 years to go. I think he's saying man's got 120 more years on this earth before I pass this judgment. So there was a 120-year warning. Noah had never seen rain before. You know, in Genesis 2, there was no rain. A mist used to come up out of the earth and water the ground. And so he's in this time, and God's saying, go build an ark, go build a boat. And he maybe doesn't even know what a boat is. Because I don't know if he ever saw a boat. But and the people around him, what on earth are you doing? Why are you building a boat in this desert? Well, it's going to rain. Well, what's rain? Well, I'm not sure, but apparently water is going to fall from the sky. And it seems from Genesis 1, if you go back to Genesis 1, that the atmosphere was separating the water in the sky from the earth. And it's hard to visualize, but if you imagine something like the rings of Saturn, which are made of debris in space, then maybe that's kind of the situation there. There was a water in the sky surrounding this planet. And it's not that different in some ways to Saturn. Now, if this was the case, then it would have created a greenhouse effect. There would have been a constant temperature over the world and hardly any wind, which means that there would have been no rain clouds. Therefore, it didn't rain before the day of Noah. And And also that would have been something that would have filtered out the radiation. And cosmic radiation is one of the causes of, significant causes of us aging. And so there was no, and that would explain why people lived longer in that, that day. Anyway, that's just a side teaching point. But anyway, I'm getting distracted again. I'm going to try and not go too long. But I was quite excited when I was kind of studying about this. I was quite excited about that. I thought, wow, I never really thought about that. And not that it's that related to Hebrews, but it is in a bit. We're getting there. Okay. Anyway, there's a lot of water. That much water falling out of the sky would have been a lot of water, would probably cause a pretty big flood. Genesis 9, then the covenant with Noah was, there will never be this kind of condemnation again. You are ushering in, Noah, you are ushering in a new opportunity for men. I mean, that's exciting. Then he makes a covenant with Abraham, and he enters into this covenant. Remember in Genesis 15, I've taught on this before, and maybe some of you have heard me speak on this before. You see that there are animal sacrifices in Genesis 15, a heifer, a ram, a goat, they're cut in half. And in the covenant traditions of the day, the two parties that make in the covenant would walk between the animals and say something to the effect of, if I fail to uphold my part of the covenant, then whatever happened to these animals, may it happen to me. That was the covenant traditions of the day. But what happens in this situation in Genesis 15, you see Abraham sleeps, and this smoking fire pot, which was symbolic of deity in the traditions of religion at that time, moves between these animals, implying that that if this covenant fails, it will be on my head. This is God walking between the animals whilst Abraham sleeps. He's saying, look, if this covenant fails, it's going to be on my head. And of course, God is the upholder of the covenant. It did fail, and ultimately it was on his head at the cross. He then makes a covenant with Moses. He establishes relationship with Israel, and the sacrificial system is established as part of that. God is completely faithful and upholds the covenant, and Israel repeatedly failed to keep their part of the covenant. The prophets speak. Jeremiah says the covenant was broken. It was forsaken. It was transgressed. Amos says the covenant was not remembered. Malachi said the covenant was corrupted and profaned. In Ezekiel chapter 20, we read, and there are similar expressions of the same thing in the prophets, you will know that I am the Lord when I deal with you for my name's sake, and not according to your evil ways and your corrupt practices, O house of Israel, declares the sovereign Lord. Hey, it's kind of, hey, it's my head that's on the line here with this covenant. That's what God is saying. It's not your head. And I'm going to deal with this for my name's sake. You can tell that something greater is coming. And ultimately, instead of an animal being split for the blood covenant, a new blood covenant takes place, and Jesus' body is torn on the cross. And the animal sacrifice and Jesus, they share one common theme, the removal of sin from the camp. The animal remains were disposed of outside the camp, and the body of Jesus was crucified outside the city. The animal symbolized it, and the offering was repeated as a constant reminder, Jesus actually did it, and it's been done for good. That's the covenant that we live under. Jesus is, in verse 1 of chapter 8, Jesus is at the right hand of God. This phrase in Hebrews, in Hebrew thought, emphasizes his sovereignty and his authority. He is the king and the high priest. He's the priest. He serves in the heavenly rule with God, but also serves in a priestly role, literally a minister or a servant. And priests did more than just offer sacrifices, but also worked as an intercessor, an example and an instructor. And Jesus performs all of these functions for us as our ultimate high priest. Jesus is the offering. He offered himself. There's no need for a mass to reenact the sacrifice. He sacrificed, therefore we have forgiveness. The old covenant was effective as a signpost to direct us, but could not supply the power. It was imperfect because we're not perfect and we could never measure up to it. It was powerless, and therefore, as God says in the book of Hebrews, it was obsolete. It's for everyone. The previous covenant was meant to be on the heart, but most did not accept it that way. The main difference for us now is that we all live under a new covenant we will know God, not just a few. Previously, only the prophets could truly know God and the priests could truly know God. And now it's for everyone. Does not matter about your past. It does not matter what you have done, what sin you've committed. It doesn't matter about your religious pride, your deserting of Christ. You can still inherit this personal relationship with God. You can walk back into that. It is an amazing opportunity. We no longer need a priest to mediate for us. Jesus is our priest. He accepts us. He covers our guilt in the presence of God. And since Jesus has paid the price through his death on the cross that establishes this as possible, we can trust that God will uphold his side of the deal. He is the upholder of the covenant. Verse 11 uses the phrase, "They will all know me." The Old Testament priests provided access to God, an audience with the king, if you like. Jesus makes it possible to know the king. That's a big difference. Isn't that amazing? We can actually know the king. We don't just get an audience with the king. Like, I met Michael Jackson once, okay? Let me tell you what happened. Okay, I was working for HMV. I was manager for HMV in the West End. Michael Jackson came into the store. Okay, unannounced. And that usually didn't happen. He had been in before, another time before my time, and it was usually announced. He came in unannounced. Our security staff ushered him in through the staff areas so there wouldn't be a big commotion. And he was in the staff elevator, the goods lift, with his bodyguards. I happened to be pressing on the lift, and the door opened, and there was Michael Jackson standing right before me with some bodyguards. And I just looked at him, and I grinned. And I didn't say anything, and then the doors closed. I didn't want to get in the lift. Now, I can't say I know Michael Jackson. I could say perhaps I had an audience with him. I met a few famous people when I was working there. Another guy I met was Robert Plant. Robert Plant, some of you may know. He was a hero of mine. He was a singer in a band called Led Zeppelin. I actually had a conversation with him. It was a good conversation. We connected. He was impressed with my knowledge of this really obscure music he was talking to me about. And he was like, "Wow, you know what you're talking about, don't you?" You know, and we connected. And I had a conversation with him. You could say I had an audience with him. I can't say I know him, even if he is my friend on Facebook. You see, it brings the relationship to a whole new level of intimacy. And in the new covenant, we have forgiveness. The passage quotes Jeremiah 31. The Bible itself predicted that the law would change. But at the time of Jeremiah, they experienced God's judgment rather than his mercy. They were in defeat. They were in exile. All those kind of things. And the promise of mercy comes at the end of that section of prophecy and is a fitting climax. But must have seemed a very remote possibility to the people of Jeremiah's day. I mean, it was several hundred years off. However, for us, it's a very real experience. God is offering forgiveness. We have to accept it. We have to accept it. For the original recipients of this letter, the drifting back to Judaism meant that they would go back to the old system, which meant that they had to go back to trying to earn God's approval by keeping the law, and that way it was weak and it was useless. Verse 13 seems to imply that the temple was still standing, but it was threatened. The letter was probably written shortly before the destruction of the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. And if the audience were not going to take heed of the letter, then God was about to allow the temple to be destroyed anyway. He's kind of saying, look, the temple's going down, it's going to crash and burn. But just to give you the heads up, I'm sending you this letter. By the way, don't forget, guys, it's all about Jesus now anyway. Forget the law. Forget the sacrificial system. It's gone. This is the sacrifice. And I guess the question this asks of us, is our faith a religion or a relationship? It's a good question for us to think about. You know, we don't come here on Sunday for an audience with the King. We live every day to connect with him, to walk with him, to share life with him, to have intimate fellowship with him. Jesus didn't come to deliver more religion. He stepped into a world and where there was lots of religion. And he spoke directly against it many times. He came to show us who is God, what this God is like, and he did it by the way he lived and the way he died. He is, as the Hebrews writer says, the exact representation of God's being. He is God. You want to know who God is? You look at Jesus, you know who God is. Think about your walk with God. What is it like? What hinders it? What holds you back? What helps you get close to God? Sometimes practical circumstances affect us. Jesus talked about the worries of this life, the deceitfulness of wealth. They choke us spiritually. Is that a battle for you? When things are going well, sometimes we can get complacent. That's me. I mean, probably that's why God keeps my life in constant crisis, because I get complacent when things are going well and arrogant. Emotional issues, things in our past can hinder us. If you had an authoritarian father figure, we can feel that we never measured up. If you have an absent father figure, we can feel that God is distant or disinterested. If you had a liberal father figure, we can feel that he's this cuddly God of grace, but with no real expectation of us. And we have to wrestle with these things, and we need each other to see who God is more clearly. And that's the purpose, really, of discipling. That's why we have our one another relationships, because we can help each other get on track with that stuff. And sin, of course, hinders our relationship with God. It goes without saying. Confessing sin is for our benefit, so that we can have a clear conscience, so that we can live with freedom of heart. It's refreshing. It's energizing. It's scary. I hate it. But actually, when you go through it, you love it, because you feel so free. You feel like this empty vessel. And if we don't confess our sin, it just eats away at us and becomes a habit, and then our hearts slowly become less responsive to God's word, and we get hardened to the message, and we become distant in the fellowship. God does not need us to confess our sin. He already knows what we did. It's not for his benefit. He knows what we did. It's for our benefit, so that we can be free. And you know, the only way we're going to make it in the long run is for us to keep praying, to keep wrestling with Scripture, to keep talking with people we respect in the faith, and to look for ways to break through the barriers preventing our intimacy with God. And we're called to be constantly seeking God. It's important that we keep growing, that we don't settle, that we take personal responsibility for our walk with God. And we're not deluded. Sometimes we can be deluded about where we are, and that's why we need another person's perspective. Some of you parents may be familiar with mymaths.com. Okay, Joel was doing some homework on mymaths.com, and it's kind of they give you some examples or some questions to fill in, and then they mark your answers, and you get a score at the end of it. And Joel was doing some algebra, and he was really struggling with this concept of algebra. And I said, well, let me have a look at it. And I was kind of trying to help him, and he wasn't getting it at all. But I ended up answering all the questions. And, you know, I mean, that was kind of silly of me, really. But I answered all the questions. What amazed me was I got them all right. I got 10 out of 10. I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive. And then at the end, you can assess how you did. And was this easy? Was this difficult? Was this really, really hard? And Joel ticked the box. It was easy. I said, what are you talking about? He said, I got them all right. Wait a minute, I answered all the questions. You need to tick this box, it was really hard. But let's not be deluded, you know. But what's the heart of what we are about? We're walking with God, it's a relationship. You know, we were on holiday recently in Cornwall, family holiday. It's interesting how family holidays, sometimes they really expose the flaws in your family life. I don't know if you've experienced that, maybe that's just me. Of course, in Woodford, we live in this nice, it's a very modest house, but it's got some space in it. There's plenty of room for us, and, you know, I can be on the bottom floor, and everybody else can be scattered between the middle floor and the top floor, and we don't get in each other's way too much. On holiday, we were in this small place. It had two bedrooms, a living area, and a small kitchenette, and by day three, we were really getting on each other's nerves. It was really hard. And I have a dynamic. When the going gets tough, I tend to withdraw a little bit. Okay, this is just one of my character flaws. And part of that is I'm processing and trying to think, what shall I do here? But part of it's just conflict avoiding, I mean, if I'm really honest. But there is some sincere intent in there, but at least. But usually when it gets really tough, I'm just conflict avoiding. But anyway, we're on day three, and it gets to the point, okay, day three, family devotional. Okay, I think what we need to do today is we need to share one encouraging thing about each other and share a challenge for each other. So we all go round and, you know, and I forget what everybody else's challenges were, but there was a lot of complaining and all this kind of thing going on. But my challenge was, you've got to put your phone away. You're on your phone all the time. And smartphones are a wonderful thing. You do a lot of things on smartphones these days. You can go on the internet. You can do all this kind of stuff. But I've been on my phone, and I'd been hurting my family by being distracted and not connecting with them. I withdrew. I stopped communicating. I started to focus my heart and my mind on something else. And initially it was a withdrawal tactic, but also I found the phone quite engaging, and I got more interested in what was happening on my phone and less interested in what was happening in my family. And the relationships in the whole family were drifting. It was my fault. But this is so easily what happens with our relationship with God. The going gets tough, we withdraw, we find something else to fill the gap. It's a drift, but it doesn't take too long for us to be at sea. And unless someone is looking out for you, it's pretty hard to get back on the shore. I'm just going to have one quick look at a verse in chapter 13, because I do feel I need to leave you with a specific challenge. Let's talk about purity. Chapter 13, verse 4. The second point, prayer, you'll get that, okay? Just pray. Okay, it's deeper than that, it's more exciting than that, that's what I was going to do, but I don't have time for that. Okay, Hebrews 13:4, marriage should be honored by all, and marriage bed be kept pure, for God will judge the adulterer and all the sexually immoral. Keep your lives free from the love of money, be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. So we say with confidence, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid, what can mere mortals do to me? The Jewish Christians, considering returning to Judaism, would be concerned about not defiling the Jewish temple. God is concerned about our temples, our bodies, the temple of the Holy Spirit. He doesn't want those to be defiled, and he warns us to flee from sexual sin. How are you doing with resisting sexual sin in a world where we're bombarded with that stuff? How's your sexual purity? Whether you're single or married, you struggle with something that you're reluctant to talk about? Make no mistake, God is not just the God of grace. He is the God of repentance and the final judge. But it's not just sexual purity that's addressed here, like many of the Pharisees and the Sadducees who Jesus confronted for their love of money. Jews aspired to have material prosperity. And the Jewish Christians were warned against greed and materialism. We live in an affluent world. Are we content with what we have, or are we always trying to get more? And often we cling to money and we forget God. Nothing steals our heart from God more than sex and money. This discontent, this grabbing more, will eat away at us unless we keep it in check. It's been a tough year for us this year. It's been a really tough year for our marriage. Nancy's gone into a demanding job. We've been used to lots of talk time in our marriage, and I'm unusual for a guy. I need talk time, okay? It's unusual. Satan saw an opportunity. Facebook. A girl who I was close to in my teenage years, contacted me on Facebook, and it was fairly innocent at first, she contacted me, it's been many years, blah, 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 and I'm like, look at my family, they're amazing, and I'm a Christian, blah, and all this kind of stuff. And then she said something in a private message, that I always regretted sending you away. You see, we never were together, but there was an opportunity, and she said no. That scared me. I talked to Nancy about it, I talked to some brothers about it, and I told her, I said, look, we can only talk on the wall here, on the public wall, not in private message. She deleted her Facebook account or blocked me or something. Thankfully. It scared me. Materialism is also a struggle. Sometimes I wish for a more comfortable life, My dad has a yacht in Greece. I've been on it sometimes. My mum lives in this holiday home in Turkey. And it's not a case of someday all this will be yours, son. And that doesn't cut it. I come from a very large family. Between us, we have 26. My parents have 26 grandchildren. That's a birthday every 2 weeks. And I'm like, I wouldn't mind this yacht. I wouldn't mind, you know, this comfortable life in Turkey. I wouldn't mind those things. And I live in a townhouse in Woodford, and every month it takes focus, effort, and some decisions about what we'll say yes to and what we'll say no to in order to balance the books. And yet this discontent can so easily eat at my heart. I have to keep it in check and remember that the Lord is my helper. The message of the Bible constantly speaks out, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. Be transformed, surrender to God's mind, God's agenda. Life is not about grabbing anymore, it's about giving. It's about what you bring to the table and not what's missing from the table. It's about trusting that God is going to take care of us and meet our needs. And this insatiable lust for more will eat at us spiritually. And I say this at a time of year when it really bombards us, and unless we deal with it and keep it in check. So the one challenge this week then is to deal with your purity issues. Sexual purity, materialism, discontent in your life. Talk about it with someone who you respect, who's going to help you wrestle with it and love you enough to keep it in check. Refocus your heart and mind on God. He will never leave you or forsake you. And I'm sorry we didn't have the time to deal with the point on prayer, but I hope that's been helpful. Thanks.
I always appreciate listening to Barry because his lessons contain so much depth and detail. And just for today, just understanding that God is a God of relationship and not religion. And how are we doing in that area? Appreciate you, even your own vulnerability, Barry, and just sharing about your own life. Really, really appreciate that a lot. And let's take to heart the challenge, just about talking to someone this week about our purity. Whether it's sexual purity or whether it's just materialistic purity or whatever it is, let's talk to someone this week about that just to make sure that we are staying close to God and that it's not just about an outward religion, but it is all about our relationship with God. Just a final announcement. We do have next Sunday, as Paul mentioned in the announcement, it's our family Christmas service. There are invitation cards right here at the front of the stage, so please come and help yourselves and use those to invite your friends, family, and your work colleagues, people you know in the area, to come along next Sunday at 11 o'clock. Just a reminder, we've got our football match this afternoon, and so as many of us who can go along there to support, that'd be fantastic. We're going to close with one final song. Let's go ahead and stand at this time.